How much do you know about women's history? Most textbooks covering the last millennium have focused on the exploits of men, largely writing out half the population. Here to help correct the record is Philippa Gregory, author of the new book, Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History. Philippa is a New York Times number one best-selling author of historical fiction, whose books include The Other Boleyn Girl, The White Queen, and Dawnlands. Now she's turned her highly regarded research skills to the world of nonfiction, and she joins us to share five key insights from her book.
Hello, I'm Philippa Gregory, the historical novelist. I've always written historical fiction from the point of view of the history first, and the fiction is really the breath of life into the bones of the real historical story. But I've always wanted to look in the background of the characters that I write about in fiction. And about 10 years ago, I started doing this. And in a very, very little while, I realized that what I wanted to write about was not the big heroines of history, but the characters that we hardly know about, our great, 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 many great grandmothers, our forebears, who don't appear in the conventional histories at all. For a number of reasons, partly that we don't literally have records of them. The only time that working class women or peasant women or ordinary women, normal women at all, get into the record is usually when they're being either criticised as a group by the writers, the clerks, the churchmen, the clergy, the lords and masters, or when they get into court for criminal offences. So you literally don't have any description of ordinary women living their ordinary lives, except for the very rare occasions when they're in trade documents. So there's very, very little material for historians to go on. And until really the 1950s, there was no interest in women's history at all. When I first went to my university, my first university at Sussex in England, I came across this sort of new history which was being written, which was a history of working people. And then a few years later, it became clear to me that the emerging feminism of those times was producing a feminist history, a history of women. And again, it wasn't just interested in the big heroic names of history, the queens that we really know very well now, but it was interested in women in business and women in trades and women in crime and women in other occupations. So more normal women, more ordinary women's stories. And this struck a chord with me then, and it's something that stayed with me all my life. And finally, after 10 years of research and writing, I produced the book that really encapsulates all that I currently know about ordinary women's lives from 1066 for 900 years till 1994. And it's called Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History. I suppose the top five things from my book, one is just funny, but I'll tell you. There are more penises than women in the Bayeux Tapestry. There are 93 penises embroidered or woven into the pictorial record of the Norman invasion of England in 1066, the Bayeux Tapestry, commissioned by a Norman lord to celebrate their victory, but significantly woven and embroidered probably by English women, and they show the violence and the degradation of women which followed the Norman invasion. So there are about five women, most of them in the margins of the tapestry, not part of the main record of the invasion, and they are always being suffering violence or suffering unwanted, non-consensual touching. There's one important lady, and she's being touched on her face by a clerk. We don't know why or what that means. And in the margins, there are women escaping rape, escaping violence, and one woman trying to get out of a burning house holding her son's hand. So the women who were embroidering and weaving the tapestry were very clear what the Norman invasion meant to women. I suppose the other thing that really came out to me from the writing and the research of this book is that mere change in the law, I say mere, I shouldn't, because it's incredibly important, but change in the law alone doesn't make a deep difference to the lives of women unless it changes the awareness of society as to what is a crime and what is not, and unless it's reinforced by really determined, rigorous policing, which itself comes from and it changes what is acceptable and what isn't. So, for instance, the change in the view of rape as increasingly unacceptable, even in domestic circumstances, even between husbands and wives, is really clear in the law. But as we know, to our sorrow and to our disadvantage, today, women of today know that domestic rapes are not prosecuted. They're not pursued by the police and they're not prosecuted in England as they should be, even now, centuries after the law made it illegal. So, although, of course, we have to campaign for equality under the law, it makes no difference unless we go on with the campaign to change people's awareness as to what matters, what is a crime or what isn't. And I suppose the third insight in this, which is related to that, is that it's not enough to change the minds of women. We have done a great deal in our society in making women more aware of their rights to be free of violence and to be free of sexual assault, but we haven't got that message through to all the men who need to learn it. And that is why women who face violence, it's in the home. It's not the stranger down the alleyway. And that's such a tragic thing to have to realise, that I'm not surprised that we are reluctant to understand it, and that as a society we're reluctant to take domestic violence and domestic sexual abuse seriously. Another insight that I had that really amused me in the research was that the history of women who didn't want the vote, anti-suffrage women, anti-suffragists, anti-suffragettes, is barely recorded. There's two reasons for this. One is the cliche that we all know, that history loves a winner. So we like to celebrate wins, and Lord knows, in women's history, we are right to celebrate the wins we have, because there aren't that many of them. But that's one reason. And the other reason is that the idea of women not wanting a vote is so alien to feminists, and most women's historians are by their very nature feminists, that it's very difficult to get your mind round these women. It's very difficult to celebrate them as women speaking out and women as heroines, because they're saying the very opposite of what we want to hear. Women Against the Vote organised themselves into the Women's National Anti-Suffrage League in 1908, and they were the dominant group. They were the biggest group speaking about women's votes, far outnumbering the much more famous WSPU, Women's Suffrage and Political Union, formed by Emmeline Pankhurst. They looked like they were certain to win the argument, which was that women should not have the vote. And the reason that they argued this, which is so difficult for us to come to terms with today, is that they genuinely believed that a woman's place was in the home, that her influence should be on domestic matters, that she did the most when she campaigned for things which affected women in the home. And that included slavery, anti-slavery, and that included, for instance, the wonderful campaign that women waged against the prosecution of women for having contagious diseases. But all these issues, these women regarded as domestic. They were inside their sphere. They were inside the domestic sphere, and they could speak on them. What they didn't want to do was to get involved in party politics, and they didn't want to get involved in House of Commons parliamentary politics, and they didn't want to get involved in voting, because they thought that the government covered the running of the country, the making of wars, and the running of the empire. And those things should only be controlled by people who were educated, experienced, and powerful anyway, who knew how to do it. Women got the vote purely as an act of logic and numbers, that after the First World War, there was a real feeling in the country and certainly in the political parties that men who had been conscripted and sent to their deaths had to be rewarded by the right to vote their government. And it made no sense at all if you said that a working man could have the vote at 21, but his employer, maybe a duchess, would never have it. And it was that lack of logic that led to women in England getting the vote, despite the fact that at the turn of the century, into the 1900s, a huge majority of women did not want it. So that's a kind of funny little aside of history. And I suppose the one other thing I'd like to share with you is why the book ends when it does, in the early 1990s. And that's because that is the moment where the Anglican Church, the Church of England, the state church, conceded that women could be vicars. Why it matters really a great deal is that throughout women's history, from the earliest terms of defining women from the Greeks onwards, there's always been this sense that women don't have a spiritual life that equals the spiritual life of men. Women are regarded as more physical, as more earthy. There's a time when women are regarded as sexier, more prone to temptation, think of Eve. And then there's a time when women's spirituality is recognised, but then it's quite late in the church's history. And then it's Mary, Mother of God, who is a model that you can aspire to, but you're not likely to reach. And still, the old image of Eve runs alongside this gossipy, sinful, sexy, difficult, argumentative, volatile, light. All of these things have kind of constellated around the idea of what women are like, and they have played a part in preventing women being acknowledged as spiritual leaders, and played a part in a whole definition of women's nature, which sort of suggests that women are lightweight, not serious. This is very powerful. This is a very powerful thread, which I think we as women sometimes feel even now. So the decision goes on for years. It starts in the early 1900s and then finally reaches conclusion in England in 1994, when finally the Church of England ordains women. And now we even have women bishops. Even now, we still have parishes that can refuse a woman vicar on the basis only that they don't want a woman representing God on the chancel steps of the church. So it's an extraordinary story. The point of it is not so much for me whether women are ordained or not, though that's important as a sign of equality. The important thing is the sign of equality that the church, the state church, finally recognises that women have equal souls in the sight of God. So thank you very much for listening to this. I'm speaking to you from my study in England, looking over a very cold field, pretty well off the top of my head. This book has been in my heart and in my mind for so long that I could talk about it for twice the length of time, but I won't trouble you with that. I hope you like the book itself and the podcast series that's coming out with it. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you, Philippa. That was Philippa Gregory with 5 Big Ideas from Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History. You might also like our book bite for The Story of Art Without Men by Katie Hessel. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.